First, a program note. The following podcast includes adult situations and language.
The trail of suspected serial killer Sam Little brought Detective Mitzi Roberts to San Diego next. Back in 1984, Little had been caught in the act. Two San Diego police officers happened upon him in the backseat of a car parked in a dark, empty lot. They lit the car up and caught Little in the midst of strangling a woman. They saved her life. That was the good news. The bad news is what happened after. There was a chance here to stop Sam Little and put him behind bars for a long, long time. But that didn't happen. And it seems to me that the San Diego stop on his violent path serves as a testament to the cracks in the justice system, as well as the failings of society in this case. To me, it's the one story that stands for the whole story. It shows that in some cases, even the best efforts of good people could not keep this man from killing over and over again. We're going to examine the San Diego case now, both the good and the bad of it, the uplifting and the sad. I'm Michael Connolly, and this is Murder Book.
You know, when I saw her, I thought she was dead.
If there he is, strangling somebody else in another state, and I'm frustrated because there's not a doggone thing I can do about it. This guy was the worst of the worst.
Thanks to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this show. Read The Cipher by Isabella Maldonado, a heart-pounding new novel about a serial killer and the woman who got away. Available now at amazon.com/thecipherpodcast. This season, our story is called The Women Who Stopped Sam Little. Last year, the FBI named Little as the most prolific known serial killer in American history. Before he was finally taken down by Detective Mitzi Roberts and the LAPD Cold Case Squad, he left a trail of dead women from one side of the country to the other. 93 killings by his own count, and the FBI doesn't doubt him. In this episode, we are going to take a look at a case down in San Diego where his victims actually survived. It's a case that gives us a good look at law enforcement at its best and the justice system at perhaps its worst. We begin on the night of October 25th, 1984. We are riding with rookie San Diego police officer Wayne Spees and his training officer Lou Tamani. I'm a storyteller by trade, but I always maintain that cops are the best storytellers. So I'm going to let Wayne Spees, now retired after a 31-year career with the SDPD, tell the story about that night without any interruption from me. Just one small note first. Sam Little was known to use different aliases. He is named Samuel Little on his birth certificate, having been given his mother's surname. But growing up, his mother left home and he was for a time raised by his father, whose last name was McDowell. Sam often used that name in his life of crime, including on the night he was arrested in San Diego. Both names are used interchangeably by the people in this story. Okay, so here is Wayne Spees and that story.
I was brand new. I was just out of the academy. And that night, we're working graveyard shift. So 9 o'clock to 7 o'clock. And that night, lineup sergeant, you know, comes in and they, you know, run the show, you know, so they are telling us what's going on here, you know, what's happening in the city and what we need to be worried about. And of course, as a trainee, and I was the only trainee in the, I think, in the division at that point, on that shift, I got to get down everything, you know, I got to race out to the patrol car, get it all squared away and stuff. But they put out a flyer, and the flyer had a picture. It was a composite sketch that they used to use, those old sketch kits where they would, you know, lay over the nose and the eyes and, you know. And the victim was from a rape and a kidnap. and composite sketch of a black male, you know, and a real good description of the car. And it was a 72 black T-Bird and, you know, fuzzy dice. I mean, the victim had some really good details about the interior of the car because she had been, you know, assaulted in the car, strangled, and then probably left for dead. I remember, you know, during the briefing, they said that, you know, he had just basically thrown her unconscious body out on the ground and then drove off. She makes her way to a telephone, calls for help, and they do the crime case. So that night, it's, you know, towards the end, I'm working in Southeast San Diego. It's busy, gangs, shootings, you know, stolen cars, dope all over the place. I mean, I'm right where I want to be. You know, I'm just loving it. And I had a good training officer, Lou Tamani. He was he's a good street cop. You know, he'd worked that area for about 4 years. So, you know, the guy I had on the first phase, I was like, I'm not really learning too much from him. But Lou was really good. Lou taught me a lot. So we're out contacting, you know, answering the radio. Well, about 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, the radio dies. So now everything's just, you know, snooping and pooping. You're out driving around trying to figure out where your next arrest is going to be. And he said, you know, we're driving down Market Street, and he says, let's check that lot. Now, the lot is at 36 and Market, and as you make a right turn onto 36, there's a hill, a little incline, and then the pavement stops, and then it's dirt. And then you go back in there, and it's dark, and there's trash dumped back there. But if you're back in there, you can't see it from the street. So a lot of stolen cars are dumped there. A lot of guys go back there to, you know, do dope and that kind of stuff. So we kill our lights going in. So, you know, we're rolling in, and as we crest that little hill there, we can see this black T-Bird sitting there, you know, so he says, pull up behind it. So we pull up about two car lengths back, and he says, all right, light it up. And so I hit the spotlight, the headlights, and the overheads. And right away, we see it's a black T-Bird, and it just matches that description of that sexual assault car. So at this point, I'm like, you know, I said that looks like the car, and we can see there's movement in the back seat, and we see, who later identified as Sam Little, we see his head pop up, and he kind of looks back at us, and then there's a lot of movement, and then he's getting out the passenger side. And as he's getting out, he's kind of disheveled, you know, and he's pulling up his pants and he's zipping himself up. Well, we're out of the car already, and we moved to the front, and I'm calling to him. I said, come here, I need to talk to you. As soon as he was out, he's looking at us, he's waving like, you know, hey, we're leaving. Everything's cool. You know, it's just me and my wife, we're out of here. And I'm like, no, I need to talk to you. You need to come back here. And, you know, again, he's walking around to the driver's side, and, you know, I'm telling him to stop, and then I just said, you need to get back here, I need to talk to you. And now he turns, and now he starts, you know, walking, and my partner's flanking him on the left, and then he is kind of making his way up to the car. And, you know, Little's just, I mean, his head's like back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, you know, looking at me, looking at him, and I'm thinking, you know, he's gonna run, you know, but he's a big guy. You know, and I'm thinking, and I'm a 24-year-old kid just out of the academy, so, you know, he ain't going to outrun me. And as he closes the distance, he's, you know, maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 feet in front of me, and I got my light on, my flashlight, and I can see the scratches on his throat. There's blood in the scratches, and then he's got what looks like a mucusy, like, clump of blood on his chest. And I just asked, I said, what's going on? And he said, my wife and I were fighting, but now we're making love. And he says, because, but we'll leave. We don't want any problem. He's being, you know, cordial, you know, and I said, well, I said, you know, why don't you show me, you know, some ID? And now he's looking back at my partner. Now my partner's focused on the back seat of the car, shines the light, and then he immediately turns and he's closing the distance. And he says something to the effect of 1016, which is, you know, a prisoner. He's arrested. He's under arrest. And now Sam knows that the gig's up, you know, and he looked at me and then he looked down at my gun. And I said something to him like, don't do anything stupid. I said, you know, you're here by yourself. And, you know, so he's looking down at the gun and then he looked back up at me. And now my partner's standing right behind him, and I just said, you need to put your hands behind your back. And he did, you know, just, you know, and then as soon as we got him hooked up, you know, he starts talking, you know, and he's just saying, you know, that bitch, you know, she tried to rip me off. I was defending myself, you know, so anyway, we put him in the back. We hurry up to the car, and she's in the back seat. The seats are completely pushed forward, and you know, the seats are up as if, you know, he was getting out. But she's in between the back seat and the driver's seat, pushed down on the floorboard, where her shoulders are down there, but her torso, her butt and stuff are up on the seat, and you know, her legs are just spread apart. And she's completely naked, but she's got a black bra, like kind of laced or just lying across the top of her chest. And, you know, when I saw her, I thought she was dead. You know, she had a lot of trauma. She had been beaten. And, you know, my partner opens the door and then, you know, he reaches down to see if he can feel a pulse. And then she started gurgling, you know. So we, you know, we pull her out, turn her over, we clear her airway. And, you know, she was really scared. And she said that I'm afraid. And I don't think she could see. And my partner said, it's the police. You're going to be okay. And, she said, he raped me. And, you know, my partner just said, okay, you know, we're going to get you an ambulance and you're going to be fine. So we call an ambulance. They come. I sat with her for a little while, just, you know, trying to keep her calm, keep her warm. And then the ambulance came, and they scooped her to the hospital. So now we got Little in the back seat of the car. We go back, I get in the car, and, my partner's driving now. So I'm sitting back there. We're both in the front seat. He's in the cage. And, you know, he's making statements to us. He's talking to us. So my partner admonished him. He waved, said, yeah, now I'll talk to you. And then he says that, you know, he picked this prostitute whore, is what he called her, up in a gay bar downtown. He said that he offered her $20 or something of coke. And he said when they got here, she wouldn't do what he wanted her to do. And, you know, he said she just, you know, took it out and played with it a little bit, but it, you know, she wouldn't do what I wanted her to do. He said, so, because it was self-defense, he said, because I wasn't going to let her rip me off. You know, so we take him to the hospital. It's not a, you know, 20-minute drive, if that. And we got to take him in to do this rape exam. The rape exam is, you know, where we're going to collect evidence from him. So they, you know, take all his clothes and impound him. And then, you know, they're pulling hairs from him, you know, from his pubic area, from his head. They swab the penis. You know, they're doing everything, you know, collecting any evidence that, you know, physical evidence that they can. And he is pissed. He is not happy about this. And, you know, he's just looking at us and he goes, you know, why do they have to do this? And, you know, there's just a lot of him yelling at the doctor or whatever. And, you know, we're just standing there just to make sure he's going to be cooperating. And then when we're done, you know, my partner says, hey, take him out to the car, put him in, and then we'll take him down to the watch commander. So I get in the car with him and, you know, there's probably 4 or 5 minute waiting for my partner to come out. And he's still mad. And he says, that kit, because I called it a rape kit. He says, that kit ain't going to show no rape. So I'm going to show where my hands were around her neck. So I'm sitting here. I'm like, he waved, but that didn't come from any question for me. And I'm thinking, I got to write this down. You know, this is a good incriminating statement, you know. And, you know, for a new guy, I'm like, this is good stuff. So I take out my pad. So he doesn't see me writing. I'm just, you know, sitting in the front seat, you know, kind of shaking my head, you know, and I'm, as he's talking, I'm writing down. He said that, you know, I should have killed that whore. You know, just statements where he kind of felt like he was the victim. But what angered him, now I know, based on what we've learned about him today, it was the rape that was making him, the accusation that he was a rapist that was making him angry. I don't think he saw himself as a rapist. If I would have said you're a killer or, you know, you're a strangler, you know, he may not have had a problem with that, but I don't know. But, you know, he was very upset about the rape, or the accusation of rape. So, we take him down and they call the detective in from sex crimes to do the interview. And that was pretty much until trial was the end of my contact with Little.
We are going to take a break here and hear from one of our sponsors. Then we'll tell how a case in which police officers caught a man in the very act of strangling a woman completely fell apart. The Cipher is the first thrilling read in a heart-pounding new series by Isabella Maldonado. The series follows FBI agent Nina Guerrera, a born fighter who is now devoted to ridding the streets of the kind of human monsters who still haunt her past. Award-winning author Isabella Maldonado wore a gun and a badge in real life before writing crime fiction. A graduate of the FBI National Academy in Quantico, she was the first Latina in her department to attain the rank of captain. In The Cipher, Nina, at age 16, escaped a serial killer's trap. Now she's an FBI agent, and her former abductor has committed a grisly murder designed to draw her into the investigation. Clue by clue, victim by victim, Nina races to stop a deadly serial killer whose online antics have made him a depraved social media superstar. His online persona is an enigmatic cyber ghost dubbed The Cipher. What's more, he's sharing every step of his game online. He uses the internet to invite the public to play along with his game. Can Nina outwit this deadly killer as the world watches? The Cipher is available now at amazon.com/thecipherpodcast. That's amazon.com/thecipherpodcast. Now back to the show. Sam Little, who at the time was using his father's last name of McDowell, was charged with kidnapping and rape and two counts of attempted murder in the two cases down in San Diego. He was assigned to veteran prosecutor Gary Rempel, deputy DA with the San Diego County District Attorney's Office. Rempel had never lost a felony case, and in a 37-year career would go on to win convictions in 23 out of 23 murder cases he brought to trial. And the first thing he did was study Sam McDowell's rap sheet to get a sense of who he was dealing with. His eyes held on the case in Florida, where Sam was charged with murder and brought to trial, but then acquitted by a jury. He called the lead detective on that case to ask him what went wrong. He was told that Sam had produced an alibi witness at trial who was convincing in telling the jury that Sam was with her on the night of the murder. We talked to Rempel by phone, and he told us about something else he learned from the detective in Florida.
And then the detective in Florida went on to tell me that he was in a poker group with a good old boy defense attorney. And perhaps the defense attorney's conscience was bothering him or something, but after there had been an acquittal at trial, because basically they had nothing for evidence, the defense attorney in a poker game told the detective, you know, Sam admitted to me that he'd done about 40 murders. There are bodies buried all over the place. I had that information, and so I knew I had a case I had to do my best job on, because this guy was definitely a serial murderer. I had that information. I knew who his alibi witness was going to be, or at least I didn't have a name, but I knew there was going to be one. And yet I couldn't use the information at all at trial because of attorney-client privilege. I was frustrated before it ever started.
Rempel may have known the stakes were high, but trouble beset the case almost from the start. A month after the back-to-back attacks Little was charged with, the first victim was arrested for prostitution. This was a problem because prior to that, she had a clean record, and she had told police on the night of the attack that she had been abducted off the street by Little and that the assault did not come out of any money for sex transaction. With her arrest, her truthfulness could be questioned at trial.
I was required by law to reveal this information to the defense attorney, and that was absolutely devastating to my case.
The other victim presented problems as well. She had a record of prostitution and addiction, and Rempel believes she had shown up for at least one of the earlier court hearings intoxicated.
She had a major drug and alcohol problem.
Despite the issues involving the victims, the trial proceeded, and both of the women testified at length about the harrowing nights they found themselves in Sam Little's hands. The attacks lasted for hours in the back seat of Little/McDowell's car, during which the witnesses said McDowell beat them and repeatedly choked them into unconsciousness, then revived them and did it all again. When he thought he had finally killed the first victim, he threw her body out of the car onto a trash pile. But she was still alive. Eventually came to and was able to get to a phone and call for help. The second victim was saved by Officers Spees and Tomani. In fact, one of the highlights of the court proceedings was when the two officers came to the courthouse to testify in the case, and the victim saw them in the hallway.
And she comes running down the hallway when she saw my partner and I, and, you know, praise Jesus, he saved me, thank God, and all the stuff. She's hugging us, and, she's like, you saved my life, and I was like, yeah, I said, yeah, I was doing my job, I'm glad you're okay, and, but it just made me feel good as a cop.
The case was largely based on witness accounts and their credibility, but Rempel offered other evidence he thought was convincing as well.
One thing I want to mention are physical characteristics of the guy who I'm going to call a natural born strangler. He was about 6'1", 225 pounds, slightly stooped, and his hands, he had the longest, most powerful fingers I've seen. I actually got a court order and had his hands photocopied and presented those photocopies to the jury as exhibits. If there was ever a guy that had the tools for strangulation, he could have strangled him with one hand. Also significant about him was that he kept his head down. He walked kind of a slouch with his head down in sort of a humble manner. Well, there was something about him that was not so humble besides the hands. He's a dark-skinned man. And if he were to lift his head up, you would see dozens of parallel white-heeled scars on his neck, the result of many women in the throes of dying, fighting for their lives and scratching his neck. I also had that for the jury to see, and I thought that was uncontroverted evidence of this guy acting as a strangler.
When it was the defense's turn to present a case, two witnesses came forth to testify.
Into the courtroom walked a frail, elderly African-American woman dressed for church in dark, extremely neat clothes, wearing a church hat, and carrying a large Bible. So there was the alibi witness.
She was Aurelia Dorsey, a woman who had traveled with Sam McDowell across the country and had alibied him in the Florida murder case and during other investigations as well. Their relationship was odd. Sam would later admit that he and Dorsey crossed the country as a shoplifting team by day, stealing clothes and selling their haul in the poor neighborhoods of the cities they visited. But by night, Sam changed from petty criminal to marauding serial killer. And Dorsey, who is long dead now, apparently turned a blind eye to it. She often cleaned her car in the mornings after Sam McDowell had killed someone in it, and she was always ready with an alibi.
They traveled as husband and wife, even though she was quite a bit older than him. And I think basically he was sort of her care provider. I think they lived off of her Social Security. Anyway, she took the stand, and she was letter perfect.
Dorsey told the jurors that Sam Little was with her at the time he had allegedly abducted the first victim. And even on cross-examination by Rempel, she stuck to her story. The second witness for the defense was Sam Little himself. He calmly took the stand and told a story about the night of the second attack when he was caught in the act, but from a completely different perspective from the two officers who had arrested him.
He had his own story to tell. And his story was that he just got to town and was just out for a night of it and had a couple of drinks and met a prostitute who solicited him. And he took her to, obviously, you don't want to do that in front of witnesses. You don't want to take a prostitute to a public place. So he took her to some place where there was no lights. And he's in the back seat with her. And they had an argument over the money. She was trying to cheat him, is what he said on the stand. I specifically remember that. She was cheating me. And so then she, when he wouldn't agree to pay a sum that he had not agreed to initially, she began to attack him. She was scratching his face and yelling, and he just grabbed her by the neck to keep her from attacking him. He claimed self-defense. And, you know, he told his story calmly. Matter-of-factly, showed righteous indignation when he got to the point about her trying to cheat him. And on cross-examination, I sure wanted to ask him what happened in Florida, but I couldn't.
Rempel said that it was his take that Sam Little came off more believably on the witness stand than his victims.
Sam, he probably made the best witness of the three.
The weakened case went into jury deliberations with Rempel still holding out hope for a conviction. The man elected jury foreman was a retired San Diego cop, and the prosecutor hoped he would see McDowell as a guilty man and be able to sway the rest of the jury. But after lengthy deliberations, a mistrial was declared, with the jury deadlocked 9-3 in favor of acquittal. Now it was decision-making time at the DA's office.
We weren't going to get a better jury led by a retired cop, and we just needed to get the best deal we could. So we offered a plea to assault with intent to commit great bodily injury as to these two. We had two counts of that, and the office told me to compromise at 4 years. At the sentencing hearing, I was absolutely lit up. I was, you know, almost yelling at the judge, who said, "Mr. Rempel, why you seem so mad? I'm giving him the most I can give him." And I told the judge, "Your Honor, I'm not talking for your benefit. I'm speaking for the future Board of Prison Terms. We used to call them the parole board. When this guy comes up for parole, I want them to do everything they can to keep him off the streets. He's a serial murderer, and I, you know, at some risk, reveal that at sentencing, even though technically I probably couldn't, but I did."
McDowell, whose real name was Samuel Little, got 4 years. He served 2.5 years before being paroled. He then headed to Los Angeles. Little would later confess that he killed two women within days of his release from prison. And from there, he kept killing. Among his victims, Audrey Nelson and Guadalupe Apodaca, the victims who 2 decades later would be linked to him by DNA and be the cases investigated by Detective Mitzi Roberts. Haunted by his knowledge of Little, Rempel continued to track him for years, often through phone calls he would receive from police investigators in other states who told him that McDowell / Little was a suspect in another case.
There he is, strangling somebody else in another state, and I'm frustrated because there's not a doggone thing I could do about it.
Indeed, in a memo Rempel filed with his office in 1985, the prosecutor pulled no punches about Sam Little. Reading now from the memo obtained by the podcast. Although the defendant is no doubt a nationwide serial killer and one of the most dangerous psychopaths I've come across, he came across very well on the stand, which accounts for his prior acquittals in other states. Rumpel goes on in the memo to say, I contacted the FBI and asked them to put him in their nationwide crime profile of MOs. Whether that ever happened is unknown.
This was the case in my career that frustrated me.
Officer Wayne Spees went back to work after the case, not knowing what became of Sam McDowell, and spent the next 30 years with the department, rising to the rank of detective sergeant before retiring. It wasn't until an LAPD detective named Mitzi Roberts came calling that Sam McDowell came back into his life.
Detective Roberts calls me, and you know, I'm a detective sergeant now. I'm working in the intelligence unit. I have an office in a FBI building. I'm working as part of a task force, and I'm just, you know, sitting in my office. I get the call. She tells me who she is, and she says, she says, 30 years ago, you arrested a guy for rape. And I said, Samuel McDowell, because that's how I knew him, under that name. And she said, you remember? And I said, I remember that one. You know, I said, I've arrested a lot of people, but I said, it's not often you get to arrest somebody in the middle of strangling and raping a woman, you know. I mean, he was on top of her when we pulled up. So, she said, we got a DNA match from your case. So she says, I need to come down and interview you. And I said, yeah. I said, you're going to want to talk to my partner too, right? And she had already contacted him. So she came down, her and her partner, I think it was Tim. And, we're sitting in, let me back up. So that night I go home and I talking to my wife and I said, I remember that case. I said, because I got a commanding officer citation for it, commendation. So I said, I think I saved all that paperwork. You know, so I go out in my garage. I have a little Tupperware container out there where I have books from the academy. And when I was going to court, I just saved those handwritten reports. I threw them in the bin there. And so I pull it out. It's got the name Samuel McDowell on it. So I bring it, you know, to work with me. So when Mitzi gets down there, I showed it to her. And, you know, she was like, you kept the report for 30 years, you know, because I guess the originals were all gone now. And I said, I kept that one.
Like many of the law enforcement officers we talked to about Sam Little, Spees is both troubled and perplexed by how the justice system could not keep Little from killing again and again.
I mean, I was surprised when I heard he did 2.5 years, because in my mind, you know, I'm thinking, this guy, I had no idea that there was a hung jury and, you know, that he was offered the deal. I was just told that, you know, he was offered a deal. And, but I'm in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, he's gone. You know, I ain't going to see him again, you know, for a while. And when I heard he only did 2.5 years, I was like, how's that even possible? But it was the victims. You know, they just, it was a hard case. You know, I mean, the attorneys aren't going to, you know, try a case that they're not going to win. You know, they're going to wait, you know, and you know, get a winning case. And they just didn't have it with this. And I know the DA just said, you know, make him a deal. But the assistant DA, the Gary Rumpel, he hated that, you know, and you know, he just said that's the one in his career. He said that was the one that, you know, gave him the most heartache. You know, it's because he got away. In his mind, he got away.
Detective Roberts collected the details of the San Diego case with Detective Tim Marsha, her third partner on this case. They secured Wayne Spees as a witness for the prosecution in the case that was building in Los Angeles. But Roberts couldn't help but wonder about all the chances the justice system had at Sam Little and how often it had fumbled. Acquitted of murder in Florida, no charges filed in Mississippi, a hung jury in San Diego. deals made here and there, months in jail instead of years. He got more time in San Diego than anywhere else, but still, it wasn't enough. It didn't stop the killing. What happened in San Diego did not surprise the detective who was now almost a year into investigating the path of Sam Little. She didn't question anyone's efforts. She knew it was a societal problem. In a world where everybody should count, Sam Little's victims did not. They were throwaway victims.
Because of the type of victims he chose, I mean, these were two cases of straight-out attempted murder and rape, and he got convicted of ADW and got sentenced to 4 years. If only one of these places would have convicted him of what he deserved to be convicted of, there would be a lot of women that were still alive today, which is really sad. He should have been in prison for a long, long time. If you looked at his record for everything he's done and equate it to the amount of time he's done, it's disgusting. But, I mean, I just go back to what Layla McLean said, and it's so true. Ain't nobody gonna believe a black prostitute in 1980 in Pascagoula, Mississippi. And it pretty much goes for everywhere he was and these girls. Nobody believed them, and the ones that did didn't really care.
Maybe one way to look at the San Diego case is to realize that, yes, it had its flaws, and Sam Little may have only served 2.5 years for those violent crimes. But at least that was 2.5 years where he was unable to put his hands around a woman's neck. How many people would he have killed in that time? How many were saved? I asked Wayne Spies if there was any sort of consolation in that.
I mean, part of me, you know, says, yeah, maybe he, if he went for my gun that night, there would have been a better outcome for everybody, you know. But you can't. You know, you can't look at it like that. I mean, you just have to say, you know, I did everything I could do that night, you know, and, you know, especially for a brand new guy, you know, later on now that, you know, I've dealt with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of victims and, you know, arrested murderers and rapists and all that stuff. But he stands out just because of what I know now. You know, it's like, I mean, at the time, he wasn't anything remarkable. You know, I mean, he's driving a crappy car. You know, he got out. He's talking to him about himself, but he wasn't like this, you know, cold, calculating guy. You know, he was a thug. I mean, he was like, you know, he was angry. He was cursing at us. He was, I hate the, you know, fucking police, all that kind of stuff. You know, I'm like. He was caught, you know, and that was it, you know. But you know, now I look at it, and of course, you know, knowing what I know, you know, the way I look at it is there's lots of bad people in the world, but there's only been maybe a half a dozen times where I've met somebody who was evil. You know, who's just, you know, like I was evil. I mean, and at the time I didn't get that. I wasn't picking that up from him or anything like that. My partner and I had this discussion. You know, he said, look, he said, you know, we didn't have anything to do with the cases since. He said, but, you know, we did our job that night, you know, so I take some satisfaction in that, but. It's kind of empty.
After contacting Wayne Spies on the San Diego case, Detective Roberts did her best to locate the two victims who had survived the 1984 attacks from Sam Little. One of the women could not be found. She seemingly disappeared forever into the netherworld of drugs and prostitution And to this day, Roberts doesn't know if she is alive or dead. The other woman was found living in another state where she was far removed from the life she had lived in San Diego, and was in fact a therapist treating people who had faced traumatic experiences. Roberts would enlist her as well to testify against Sam Little and to tell her story of narrowly escaping death at his hands. Victimized over a quarter of a century before, she would become one of the women who stopped Sam Little. I'm Michael Connolly, and you have been listening to Murder Book. We will be back next week with the trial of Sam Little. I want to thank our listeners, our sponsors, and our consultants. Murder Book is produced and edited by Terrell Lee Langford. Music is provided by Grace Kelly, including our theme song, By the Grave. Post-production services are provided by Authentic, and Emma Kikuchi is post-production supervisor. Jane Davis is in charge of our social media, and if you want to see photos and other material from the case, go to murderbookpodcast.com. Remember, subscribe to the podcast at applepodcasts.com/murderbook if you want to be alerted to new episodes and other announcements. And if you have a friend who likes true crime podcasts, make sure you tell them about this one. Finally, leave us a rating and a review at Apple Podcasts. This is Michael Connolly saying thanks for listening.